Hey guys, Melissa here. I blog at our family website, www.thecorkums.com, which we affectionately call the Corkboard. This is the Uncorked Podcast. If I had to choose a descriptor for our family, it would be outside the box. Whether it's adopting three unrelated adolescents out of birth order, or trying to run a coffee shop in our quote-unquote spare time right after adopting, we love adventure. We had to give up that coffee shop, and our three oldest kids are launched for now. But with lots of extended family living at home and a full-time wellness business, there still aren't many dull moments. We've met so many amazing people with fascinating stories along our journey. I'd love to introduce them to you. Hey guys, this is episode 11 of the Uncorked Podcast. How was everyone's holiday week? My husband and I had this epiphany that neither of us really like turkey, and he doesn't even really like any of the traditional sides. So we pretty much live outside of the box, and I'm thinking our years of having a traditional Thanksgiving might be numbered. Do any of you celebrate with different favorite food? Sushi? Barbecue? I need ideas. Anyway, I digress. My guest this week is Risha Jobe, and I apologize in advance for the less than stellar sound quality in this episode. Sometimes I record in my car while I'm waiting for the kids to finish their activities because, well, so goes life. And for some reason, every time I talked, it reset Risha's audio volume to like nothing. And then the longer she talked, the louder she gets. So I did my best to even it out, but let's just say you've been warned. Anyway, Risha does the most amazing trauma work using horses. Towards the end, she tells the story of the transformation of a boy that brought me to tears when I first heard it and gave me the chills while I was editing. So powerful. So without further ado, here's Risha.
All right. Well, this week I'm welcoming Risha Jobe to the podcast. So Risha, welcome.
Thank you.
Risha and I connected through our essential oil doTERRA world, and I started to see some posts about some trauma-informed services and I guess some research that she was doing. And of course, my ears perked up because we have kids from hard places through adoption, and so I've been super passionate about trauma-informed care and education and parenting and really trauma-informed anything I can get my hands on for the last 5 years. And so I was super excited when Risha decided to come and spend a little time with me. So Risha, go ahead and introduce yourself a little bit to the audience. Kind of what do you do and where did your passion come from for this particular, I guess, niche of services to children and families?
Okay. Thank you, Melissa. I am really excited to be here. I'm Risha Jobe, and I am a TFEAP practitioner and equine professional. TFEAP stands for Trauma-Focused Equine-Assisted Psychotherapy. It is the natural lifemanship model of equine-assisted psychotherapy. It's a principle-based model, and it's rooted in the neurobiology of trauma and attachment with a focus on healthy relationships and connections as the avenue for healing and change. So I work alongside a licensed therapist and an equine of some sort, a horse or a donkey or a miniature horse or a mule, to help many different clients from many different backgrounds heal from the neurobiological insults of trauma. And that includes children, adults, biological families, divorced families, adopted, foster families, all sorts of people. Anyone who's had any sort of trauma, or which includes pretty much most of us. We all have trauma on some level. And my family, my father and my stepmother are the co-creators of the natural lifemanship model. So my brother also works in this field. So it's kind of a family business a little bit. And I got into this work, you know, when I was thinking about this question, I usually tell a story about how I went to business school and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I just got a marketing degree and then I went and worked for backcountry.com and did online marketing for a while. And I just wasn't feeling very fulfilled. And so I started looking other places and started looking back at my roots, which involved horses. I grew up with horses all my life, and it also involved helping others because that's something my parents did all my life. So I kind of talk about how I just changed career paths and wanted to do something that was more fulfilling for me, and this is what led me down this path. But as I really started digging into this and thinking about it a little bit more, I have a little bit of a different story. It's kind of the same, but it has some deeper roots. So for most of my childhood, my parents worked at two residential child care facilities in Texas that treated, housed, and cared for children from hard places. So my brother and I grew up with a lot of quote-unquote adopted brothers. We went to school with them. We attended church with them. We worked and played alongside them. They were a part of our lives. We lived in a home with them. And even though my parents had not officially adopted them in any way, we were very much like an adopted family. And when you grow up in residential care, whether you're the resident or you're the child of a staff who works there, you become part of a community that is quite a bit different than other communities. When all of the children in your neighborhood are children from hard places, you experience life differently. And I've come to kind of experience it as a double-edged sword. On one hand, I think it has contributed greatly to my talent for working with kids from hard places and their families, because I literally have a lifetime experience in navigating those kinds of relationships. And I've developed some strong, deep neural pathways for tolerating and working comfortably in some very difficult situations. But on the other hand, it has also had some detrimental effects to my development, because I have less opportunity to see what we would call, you know, normal, healthy relationships modeled when I was younger. So that, coupled with my own family of origin challenges, created some of the same vulnerabilities in me as an adult that one would see in a lot of the residents of these facilities that I grew up with. So it's a blessing and a curse. And all that to say that I think those experiences are what really fuel my passion for this work on a deep, visceral level that I'm just now becoming aware of. And that I know when I started this work, I had absolutely no awareness of it.
Thanks for sharing your story, because I didn't know that about you. And of course, my husband and I are raising quite a few kids from hard places. And so it makes me want to dig in deep and say, like, you know, spend the whole podcast asking about your sibling experience. And just, you know, you already talked a little bit about there was a plus side, and then there was a downside, obviously, as well. And as is with, you know, most life experiences, I would say, or all life experiences. But what would you say growing up that you wish had been different, or that you wish your parents had been more mindful about in raising you and your brother in a situation like that? Like, maybe not that you would change it all completely, but...
Yeah, so I want to preface whatever I say with one thing I do absolutely understand, is that you don't know what you don't know, and you can't do anything about it until you do know. So I know at the time my parents were doing what they knew and everything they could, and had definitely always had our best interests at heart and were doing the best they could. So I remember as a kid growing up, whenever I was struggling with some of my own issues, I think a lot of times I didn't feel like there was enough emotional space for me to actually have any kind of deep struggle in life, because my parents were always so taxed out in providing that emotional space for kids who, you know, had it worse than I did. And, you know, again, it's there's two sides to this. On one hand, it gave me some respect for what I did have, and an awareness and an appreciation for the things I did have. And then on the other hand, it kind of taught me to ignore myself, because, well, I don't have it as bad as they do, and I have all of this, so this problem isn't really a problem, and I should just, you know, suck it up and ignore it.
Yeah.
That creates lots of other problems when you stuff all of that down. And when you get in the habit of building those pathways in your brain to ignore yourself and disconnect from yourself for the sake of others.
Interesting.
Had known more. They didn't know. They just didn't know. They didn't start understanding all of this stuff about trauma and about, you know, how their own stuff and everything that was going on around us affected us. And they didn't learn that till we were adults. So it would have been awesome if they would have been able to just have a basic understanding of how all of that might have been affecting us as we were growing up. But they didn't.
Yeah. I have a...
It wasn't out there.
Yeah, my parents, I'm actually an adult adoptee, and I know that my mom has said before that she really wishes that she had had different resources because they did the best that they could, but there's just all the research on trauma-informed care is so, so new, generally speaking, and it certainly was not available, you know, 3 decades ago when she was raising us, and I know she carries a lot of that responsibility, which she shouldn't because it just wasn't there. It wasn't that it was there and she was ignoring it or for any, you know, lack of trying or any of that. But I know now that she looks at a lot of the trauma-informed tools that we have, she thinks back and thinks, oh, gosh, you know, if only.
Yeah.
If only we had known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my parents as well. And the great thing is that they're both in this field in some capacity. And so, you know, going back and being able to have those conversations from us all coming from the same place of knowledge and even now building some new connections in our brains and between us that have been really healing as an adult, you know, in that way I'm very fortunate.
Yeah. Do you ever feel like there's a gift in, and I know that stuffing emotions down long-term and all the time is definitely problematic. And I'm going to say this out loud, and it's going to sound a little bit ridiculous because I am totally on board with therapeutic parenting and connectedness and emotional intelligence. But I guess there's always this like devil's advocate on my shoulder that says, is it almost too enabling to be like super connected to your child and his or her feelings to the point where we're like hyper-focused on them and that there's a situation and a balance or something where there's a little bit of that, nope, this time you need to just pick yourself up and, you know, I guess deal with it in a different way or, you know, I don't know. Like, I feel like, is there a strength to, you know, I couldn't indulge every emotion that came down the pike because of what my parents were doing. And so obviously, like I said, it's not healthy to not engage any of them, but is there a certain filtering with emotions that is healthy where we don't always give them the space to grow and become powerful in our lives?
Yeah. I mean, that's really what self-regulation is all about, is learning how to not let our emotions drive the bus. But I think what happens is that people get it really confused with just not feeling them at all. One thing I have learned from the work I've done with a lot of these kids and their families is that there is definitely a balance between completely indulging all of those emotions and helping our kids connect with themselves so that they can understand what they're feeling and they can express it and frankly mess it up a few times until they can figure out how to manage that better. So if you think of a toddler who is throwing a tantrum because he didn't get the cookie he wanted, there's emotion. There's an emotion that they're feeling at that moment. And learning how to manage that is a big part of our job. And being able to connect with that emotion is the starting place for them to be able to connect within themselves. And that's the starting place for them to be able to learn what to do with those emotions. So,
yeah. Is that a really fine line? Like, what does that look like practically? It sounds like a really fine line. What does the response that to a child with a big emotion look like that's asking them to disconnect from their emotion versus the response that's asking them to regulate the emotion?
Yeah, so it's the difference between validating their emotion and telling them that that's not what they're experiencing. So it seems ridiculous when a toddler is crying over something so small like that. And part of what we have a tendency to do is say, don't feel bad about that thing. That's not appropriate. And in those moments is when we start teaching them that what you're feeling is not valid. What you're experiencing, your experience of the situation is wrong, and therefore you need to start disconnecting from that and start connecting to what my experience of the situation should be. Instead of, and it's the difference between saying, Yeah, that is really upsetting. It is really upsetting when we don't get what we want. And here's what we do about that.
Mm, really good. So what are some of those tools that you teach parents to teach their kids or that you teach adults? You know, the first step is recognizing that emotion, being able to name it, being able to accept it. But then what's next? And what are some of the tools that you use in your practice and when you're working with folks?
Well, so one of the greatest, and I don't want to call it a tool, but one of the greatest resources we have is the horses. And when kids or parents get into a space with a horse, because horses are prey animals, they're wired for survival. So they're picking up on the smallest cues in our body. They're picking up on changes in our heart rate. They're picking up changes. They're picking up on changes in blood pressure and breathing, because that's something that they have high attunement for, because that's what helps them survive. When they can connect to other members of the herd who are far away, the sooner they can pick up on anything that says there might be a threat around, the better chance they have for survival. So horses are really highly attuned to what our body is doing and what our emotions are saying. So our emotions change what happens in our body, and vice versa. What happens in our body changes our emotions. So when you get around a horse and you start experiencing certain emotions or feelings and changes in your body, the horses respond to that. And in order to get a different response from the horses, you have to start connecting with what that is inside of you and doing something different for yourself before you can ever get a different response from the horse. And that is one of the key pieces for any of the families we work with, for the parents to understand what's going on inside of them when they're facing all of these challenges. Because what's going on inside of them informs their kids of how to respond. And you can't fake it. Especially with a lot of traumatized kids who are already hypervigilant. They're picking up on cues at the level that horses pick up on cues.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so when parents get to experience that with a horse, when it's a lower stakes relationship, right? This isn't my child, but it is a being who is going to respond differently when I change something about myself. They get to practice some of the things that help them build better pathways in their brain for handling this different type of being, this being who is experiencing the world much differently than we are.
So do you often see parents and kids together? And I love how you're talking about helping the parent become more attuned to their body through the attunement of the horse, because I think a lot of times, and one of the biggest takeaways that I've ever had from training in therapeutic parenting is, as parents, we control ourselves and ourselves only. We influence our kids, but we can't change them. We can't control them, which is really what would be convenient, right? And what we, a lot of times, are looking to do, but that a lot of times, because most of all of the control really lies in ourselves, that the best strategies that we have are in our own self-attunement and self-regulation. So, I mean, do you have situations where, because I have some situations, and I've had situations with my kids where just being with that kid is so triggering just to me because of a long history of circumstances. So where, you know, where you're, the idea is that the parent is working with the horse to find that attunement, and the kids maybe just, I mean, playing or doing something else. Is that what it looks like sometimes?
Yeah, well, so sometimes, and it just depends on, you know, scheduling and just what we can make happen. But we really try to have first a few sessions with parents, just with parents, where they have some space and time to do this on their own. And they get to learn all about this. We talk a whole lot about neurobiology of trauma and how we change the brain, and they get to experience that for themselves with the horses. So they get to do a little bit of work on their own first and experience what it's like. And that also helps us all get on the same page as we start working with the child, because the child's going to be experiencing a lot of the same stuff the parents have already experienced, and that way we all have a similar language around it. And so then from there, the parents, ideally, this is not true in every case because you just can't control that sometimes, but ideally, we want the whole family involved in some level in the session. Sometimes they're just there observing and the kid is working with their horse. Sometimes the parent is working with a horse and working alongside the kid who's working with a different horse, and they're both working on all of this together. You know, sometimes siblings might come, just depending on where we are in the therapeutic process, whatever is appropriate. And they might come and start being a part of that experience because then they get to experience how they can best support the whole family system. Because it doesn't matter what your family looks like, it's a system. And when one part of the system is in trouble or struggling, it affects the entire system. And it takes all parts of the system to help repair that. So we really try to get everybody involved. And that's not always possible. Sometimes we have parents who, for whatever reason, because of, you know, what they're going through on their own or financially or whatever, can't. And we just do the best we can with the kids and help them start getting the sense of what you were talking about, which is the only one in this world I have control over is me. And I can build some neural pathways for making some good choices, then my life changes.
What a powerful experience and lesson to be able to do that. I love that idea of the system and the family, though. And this circles back to, you know, what you were talking about having an experience as being more the sibling in the situation. And just kind of imagine, like, if, you know, the providers when you were growing up had looked at you guys more of a system and thought about that. And I also think just for my most fragile and then therefore most difficult kids, you know, their shame in what their behaviors are when they're dysregulated is so big, and their self-image of themselves as being the troublemaker or the hard kid or whatever is really, really ingrained. And it also makes them really resistant to therapies because it feels like I'm the problem. I'm the one that needs to go get fixed, if you will.
Yeah.
And one of the big tenets of therapeutic parenting that we train parents on is, you know, when at all possible, try to stay on the same side as your child. You know, when you explain things, when you, you know, look at a situation, try to explain it in such a way that you guys are on the same team. You're not pitted against each other. So, you know, it might be you and your child angry at past circumstances or traumas that have created the situation you're in versus like me versus your behavior. And so I love that the way that you approach it in an ideal situation doesn't make it feel like to the child, you know, I'm the one that needs to be fixed and I'm the one who's going to therapy. And I'm guessing you get a lot of rapport that way by starting off with the parents.
We do, and we also find out who's going to do the work.
Yeah.
Because some of them, they're, for whatever reasons, aren't, because they're just not at that place yet where they can. And it also helps everybody see that, you know, parents often, and even siblings often, don't have any awareness of the trauma that they're experiencing, that they have either previously experienced or that they are experiencing as a part of this new situation. And it's just because any time that you don't have the resources or the tools to successfully thrive in a situation, it creates a traumatic experience.
Yeah, I love that definition because I think so often, and I talk a lot about this with parents that I work with, you know, and I know that 5 years ago, if you had said to me trauma, I immediately think like the big car accident or like the war zone or really obvious abuse situation. And when I started learning about the things that especially children's brains, but adult brains too, process as trauma and the way that that changes the way that we relate to the world, I was really stunned. And it really explained a whole lot about my life and the lives of people around me. And it gave me a whole new perspective at how I look at the way people relate to their circumstances. Because when I think about variety and the myriad of things that can be processed as trauma in our brains, and then I think about how that's affecting all the people walking around me. It's really, really eye-opening.
It is. That's what you're talking about. That's that connection with yourself. That when you get a different connection with yourself, you start having different connections with everything and everybody else around you.
I love that. I'm going to switch topics real quick on something else that you said in the same sentence that you were talking about, the family system, which is payment and finances and all of that stuff. Is anything you guys ever do and your team does ever covered by insurance?
So currently with the therapists I work with, none of the therapists I work with right now are on any insurance panel. So they charge private pay, but then they offer a super bill. And a lot of the insurance companies cover a portion of that. Unfortunately, equine-assisted psychotherapy just costs a lot more because you have the horse involved, and horses are just expensive animals to keep. And then you have two professionals working at the same time. So it does cost more, and it's still such a very new field that there's not a whole lot of, it's not widely accepted by insurance companies as a valued form of therapy. And so we have that challenge, and then we also have the challenge of it costs more than other therapy, but it gets to things a lot quicker than traditional types of therapy. So I have a couple of therapists that will say that they can get in one session of TFEAP what it takes them 5 sessions to get in an office setting. So it's extremely valuable, but we still don't, I think this is just the case for therapy in general. We don't place the right kind of value on it yet.
Totally agree.
Yeah. And so it's hard to get insurance companies to pay for it. So usually what ends up happening is insurance companies end up paying for a small portion of it. And it's just a challenge that we're all facing in the field. There's a few nonprofits out there who do equine-assisted psychotherapy. We have a few in our area that for people who can't pay, don't have the resources, that they can go there. But those places are, they have super long waiting lists. And even for some of our private pay clients, we have long waiting lists. Because
yeah.
A lot of times, unfortunately, if people could come to this first, this would be awesome. But because it's such a new form of therapy, oftentimes what happens is people will come to it after they have been through several different types of therapy already, and they're desperate.
Yeah, we've totally, we've been in that place, so I totally know what you're talking about. So if there's any lobbyists or any other people with some pool listening, we could use some, way to push this through so that insurance companies pay for it. That would be great.
Absolutely.
What are some of the biggest wins that you've experienced? Do you have any stories that, obviously don't compromise anyone's privacy, but what are some of the things that you've seen that just really reinforce that you're doing the right thing, that you're in your passion, and that this is helping other people and kind of worth all the different things that brought you here?
Oh, this is maybe not going to seem like a big win to a lot of people, but hopefully once I tell the story, maybe at least some of you will understand why this is a big win. We have worked with a lot of very, very traumatized children who have come from, birth mothers who were addicted to drugs while the child was in utero, who were also still addicted to drugs after they were born, kids who have lived on the streets and were walking around by themselves on the streets as soon as they could walk, and had multiple different caregivers and all sorts of things like this, right? Lots of abuse, lots of neglect. And we had a client who came from this kind of extreme kind of trauma. And he was adopted into a very wealthy family who already had some, I think, 4 children who were very successful in sports and school and everything they were doing. And they felt called to adopt, and they adopted this boy. He was 10. And because of all of his trauma, he just didn't know how to behave in that kind of family. And some things happened within the family that scared the parents for their own children. And so by the time he had come to us, they were on the edge of this being a failed adoption. And when we got this kid, he was completely shut down. he looked terrified when you asked his name. When you just said hi to him or asked his name, he looked completely terrified. And his eyes were big, and he was always, you know, kind of collapsing in on himself as he was sitting there, and he was looking to everybody else to see if what he was saying was the right thing to say, even if it was just his name. So we were starting at a very, very vulnerable place for him, and we didn't know much about him. But when he went to meet the horses for the first time, he had barely talked to us at all. He couldn't make eye contact. He wouldn't hardly acknowledge his parents. They were just really struggling with him. He went to meet the horses the first time. One of the horses connected with him immediately and just stood beside him very quietly and calmly. Kind of came up behind him and stood beside him. And he decided, this is the horse I'm picking. And we were like, okay, why that horse? You know, why do you want to pick this horse? This is just the one I like. And I said, okay, so how do you know? From what I can see, it doesn't even look like you even looked at him. Like, how do you even know what he looks like? And I asked him to close his eyes and describe the horse to me. And he hadn't seen this horse except, as far as we could tell, in his periphery. And he was able to describe this horse to a T. That's how hypervigilant he was. And
wow.
He began working, yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. He began working with this horse, and we were starting from the very, very bottom. And I think it took about 3 months before we ended up in a session where we just said, look, we're working on connection. I'm having connection with himself and connection with another being. And he couldn't even give his horse a greeting. He would do these half, you know, like, oh, hi, kind of things, which he did with everybody. And it was really causing him a lot of problems. He couldn't connect with anyone because he just kept blocking all of it because of all of his trauma, of course. He had lots of reasons to do that. Lots of very good reasons. And we just said, look, this is so important that you learn how to connect with others. And it's so important that you learn how to just give your horse an authentic greeting. That we're just going to stay here and wait and be supportive of you until that happens today. And it's so important that we're willing to stay as long as we need to stay to help you with that. And it took 3 hours that day. And it took this horse doing everything he could to try to get this kid to engage. The horse would go up to him and kind of tussle his hair with his lips. And this kid would just look down and ignore him. And then the horse would walk away for a little bit. And then he would come back and he would kind of nibble at his shirt. And this kid would ignore him. And the horse would walk away, and you could see he would kind of sit. He would sit by himself for a little bit. I swear he was thinking, "What can I do next?" And then he'd walk over, and he'd kind of start pawing at this kid's foot with his hoof, just really gently. You know, it wasn't aggressive. It was just this very light touch on his foot, and he would ignore him. And this played out in a million different ways in those 3 hours until the kid had sat down in a chair, and the horse went over to him, and he put his head on his shoulder, and he just wouldn't move. And then he put his leg over the kid's leg and essentially gave him a horse hug while he was sitting there in the chair. And he finally came out of his dissociation and his fear of being connected, and he stood up, and he petted his horse, and he gave him his eyes. His eyes shifted, they lightened up, you could actually see him inside, and said hello to his horse. And that was our session, and it just all started turning from that point on, because he got to experience a genuine connection from another being who genuinely just wanted to connect, maybe for the first time in his life.
I love that, and I am with you. I don't know about all the listeners out there, but I'm like tearing up because I know that was such a big win for you all and for him. And I just love that you didn't give up, that the horse didn't give up, that there was space to let that session go where it needed to go. Because I find so often that as humans, it's really hard to love a black hole. And I didn't realize how hard it was until I was called to do it. And it's hard to keep doing what that horse did a million times in those 2 hours, to go back and put yourself out there and be rejected. And therapists have busy schedules. So just at a really practical level, it's not always practical for a therapist to be able to say, like, I'll sit with you until you're ready. And I've seen so many kids be given up on, or, you know, professionals say, oh, they're not, you know, they don't give the space and time. They push because they need to do it in an hour or 45 minutes or whatever. And it drives fragile kids further and further into their holes. And then, you know, I've had therapists say to families, you know, well, your kid's too hard, or we're not going to deal with that. Or, you know, it's seen as noncompliance, and so it just gets chalked up as another misbehavior and all these things. And I often think they just need more time, and people give up so quickly. And you think, well, if that session had been an hour and a half and the kid needed 2 hours and he was close at an hour and a half, and then someone shut him down because we didn't have enough time, like, you know, to even get that close and then be shut down is almost another traumatic experience, and, you know, almost just as detrimental. And so I just love that opportunity and the just time, and to understand the kids and understand why their behaviors are what they are, and to see the true, their little true selves in there. And as one of my favorite mentors ever said, their preciousness, which is always what Dr. Purvis would talk about. Like, you know, just remember that there's a precious kid in there, no matter how obstinate or obnoxious or all of those things that they can be. And I know for really fragile kids like that, that that genuine connection at the end of that 2 hours, even though that was like the only piece that you got for that session, is huge, like such a huge win.
Fortunately, the parents were able to see that and to celebrate with us. And I think that was a huge piece for him, because sure, he'd ever genuinely felt that.
And when we see, as parents, when we see those wins, as small as they may seem, they're big, because those little things help us fill our compassion tanks up, and they help us get glimpses of what the possibilities are. And honestly, as parents, like, we don't need much for us to grab onto those threads of hope. You know, we just need a little bit. And sometimes we just don't get that little bit even, which is so frustrating, because we're thinking in our heads, I don't need much, kids. Just give me something. And you're not getting it. And so I can imagine, as a parent, if I was that parent in that situation, I mean, that little, it's like Pavlov's dogs, right? Like, if you just feed me something when I ring the bell, like, once every 1,000th time, like, I'll still keep coming back. I'll stick with you.
Yeah, that's incremental reinforcement.
Yeah, and it doesn't take much, but I can totally see that being a win, not because of its action in and of itself, but because it bought so much more patience and time and compassion in the long run. It was such a huge return on investment. So yeah, thanks so much for sharing that.
It was, and we were really lucky that we could provide that day. He happened to be our last session of the day, and we both just looked at each other and said, let's just do it, because this had been going on for several sessions, and we just decided, that's it, today we're tackling this.
Yeah.
And we were really fortunate to be able to do that, and unfortunately, that's just not the case a lot of times, logistically, for both therapists and parents. And the reason I want to address that is because I don't want people to feel discouraged and to think that this can only happen if you have this one magical space of time where you actually get to do that. It can happen. It's holding that expectation over different periods of time, which is essentially what this horse did, because a horse's sense of time is much different than ours. For this horse, that might have been more like several weeks to him than just a couple of hours to us. And he exemplified how to do this so well, in that he asked for connection. And when he didn't get it, he didn't go off and disconnect and say, well, whatever, I'll just wait until you decide you're ready for it. He did what he could in the moment. And when he couldn't do any more, he walked off and he thought, and then he came back and he tried again. He did what he could in that moment. And then when he couldn't give any more or do any more, he didn't walk very far off. He just walked a little bit off, and he was still connected with what was going on. He wasn't off somewhere else in his mind. And then he came back and he just did that over and over and over and over again. And for that horse, that was probably several weeks worth of work just for that one little bit of genuine connection.
Do you guys have like a national network, you know, for all the people that aren't in Texas and aren't in your backyard who are at the end of their ropes and thinking, I need you in my backyard? Is there like a national, I mean, I know there's equine assisted therapy all over the country, you know, I've seen it, but in terms of the trauma-informed piece and the model that you guys are using, what does that look like? Is that replicatable? Are you guys duplicating that in other areas?
Yeah, so we are. So I'm a practitioner of this, but I'm also a natural lifemanship trainer. So we travel, and natural lifemanship as a model is still very new. I think it's, oh gosh, I'm a little bit embarrassed to say I should know this by heart, but I don't. I think this is about 7 or 8 years old. So it's still very new as a model, but has been growing exponentially over the last 3 years. So we travel all over the United States and provide trainings in trauma-focused equine-assisted psychotherapy to therapists and equine professionals across the country. So we have a growing network. It's still, in terms of other networks of other types of therapies, it's still pretty skeletal. But we have increased the number of trainings we've done. Like, we've grown 85% over the last, each year over the last 2 years. So it
wow.
continues to grow. We do have a practitioner listing. So people who have completed at least one natural lifemanship training and are members of natural lifemanship therapists and equine professionals can put their information on the natural lifemanship website under the practitioner listing. And people can also email us, and we will do the best we can to connect you with someone who is either beginning to provide services in the area, or maybe will know someone in your area who might provide this particular type of service. I wish it was bigger than it was, but we're getting there.
Yeah, it takes time. So do you request for training? So like, if there was a group of therapists or an equine program, could they reach out to you and say, hey, could you, you know, think about coming up this way?
Absolutely. Just get on the website. I think there's a link. It's naturallifemanship.com. So it's like natural horsemanship, but it's, instead of horse, it's life, because we want all of this stuff to transfer to our lives. It doesn't do us any good if it only works with horses. So naturallifemanship.com, and I think if you go to the homepage and you look under trainings, there should be a link that says host a training.
Awesome. Well, we'll make sure that gets to the show notes page.
Yeah, so people can request to host a training, and we will come out there and we'll train whoever shows up.
Excellent, excellent. All right, so in closing, what are some of your biggest challenges? And kind of in that same vein, I've been asking a lot of my guests lately for kind of a call to action. And it can be, your audience can be whomever you want, whether it be encouragement for families kind of in the trenches, or even a call to folks who could be support people, to families, kind of what's something practical that you, if I could give you a soapbox, what would you encourage people to do?
So I'm going to go with this, and I'm going to go with this knowing that it might not be well received by some people, but I think it's just really important. It's the biggest difference and the biggest challenge actually we see in sessions and that we see with the work we do is that people generally do not have a good connection to themselves. They haven't done their own work, but they want someone else to do it. They want the other person over there to do their work so that my life can be better. And when we think about connection and we think about developing healthy relationships, the place it all starts is in connection with ourselves. And so I think the call to action for everyone, whether you're doing this kind of work, whether you have adopted children, whether you foster children, even if you're just raising your own biological children, even if you have no children and you're just existing in this world, I think the most important thing any of us can do is develop a deep, intimate connection with ourselves and get to know us, get to know yourself. And that means all parts of you, the light side and the shadow side. And start learning about your own attachment and start developing an understanding of how that might be affecting all of your relationships, and discover what you want, what kinds of relationships you want, and start developing that kind of relationship with yourself. I can only control me. And if we all start doing that within ourselves, we won't have to do anything else to see a huge change.
I love that. And I love that piece that says, whether we're parents or married or whatever stage of life we're in, at the end of the day, we're all walking and talking and interacting with people every day in lots of different relationships. And unless you're the hermit in the mountainside, you know, there are multiple relationships and relationship dynamics that we all navigate every day. And this work and this trauma work and this self work and this, you know, attunement work and the attachment work is relevant to everyone, even if we're not parenting kids with attachment disorders. And so I just think that that's a beautiful way to challenge everybody. And what a great world it would be, right, if we could all get a handle on ourselves and our triggers and how we relate to everyone.
Yeah, and just as a disclaimer, I'm one of those people that has to work on that. Right? This is for everybody. So I'm not preaching. This is something I'm in the process of myself, and it's hard.
It is. I always talk to, when I am coaching or mentoring families or individuals, that I do it not because I've arrived, but because it keeps me more accountable. Like, I feel like when I'm in that role and I'm, you know, lending a hand up to another person, it keeps me accountable. It keeps me, you know, attuned and aware to what I'm doing, because I want to be the best self I can be when I'm looking out and trying to help people. And so it's really like for my own benefit in some ways, like my own sense of self-discipline to keep reaching out to other people, because I know unless I'm reaching out to other people, I don't have a reason to keep myself in check and to keep doing that hard work.
Yeah.
Way more about me than the fact that I'm an expert. In fact, it would be quite the opposite.
Yeah, but that in itself is what makes it so valuable, right? Because we can't take anybody through a place we haven't. We can't take anyone to a place we haven't been ourselves.
Yeah. So wonderful. Well, I am thrilled. I was thrilled before we started. I'm like triply thrilled now that we got to chat and I got to get to know a little bit more about what you do. I'm super excited to chat with families about this and encourage families. And I think your stories have brought a lot of hope. There's even situations in my life, a particular situation, I'm thinking, I need to be the horse in this particular situation. And so thanks for that. It's challenging and encouraging all at the same time. Again, I'll make sure that your website is up on the show notes page so that everyone can find you who's listening and is thinking, I need to get my hands on this somehow, somewhere. And I'm excited to see it spread and to do whatever I can do to help get it accessible to more people. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, I've enjoyed this tremendously.
Guys, wasn't that story of the horse and the boy incredible? I love the hope that Risha brings when she talks so confidently about the brain's ability to build new connections. Clearly, I need to work on this since I basically asked her if stuffing my emotions was just better sometimes. I'm the first one that needs to step up to her call to action to work on myself. Seems to be a theme these days. I think God's trying to teach me something. Anyway, what was your biggest takeaway? Let me know on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. I'm at M.A. Quirkum at all of those places, or .com/M.A. Quirkum at all of those places, depending on whether you're in the app or using the website. Does anyone even use websites these days? Anyway, use the hashtag #TheUncorkedPodcast so we can all share together. This is also where you can share what you ate on Thanksgiving. The less traditional, the better. It would be great to hear your feedback from the show. If you love it, please rate the show on iTunes or Stitcher. I really appreciate it. If you want to hear more about what Risha's family is doing, the website is naturallifemanship.com. You will be able to find the link on my blog at www.thequirkums.com. I'm so glad you found us, and hopefully we'll hang out again next week.